At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you like, higher home sales or higher interest rates? One means the economy might be doing better. The other means the same thing. And both of them happen today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, May 24th today. Good to have you here. Let's be clear that what we've got is a glimmer, just the faintest chance that maybe, perhaps, just possibly the housing market's turning around. We got the numbers for April new home sales this morning, and here's where the first caveat comes in. They're only about 15% of all home sales. Caveat number two is that we've all been here before, latching on to a moving target to try to pin down a huge part of the economy. Marketplace's Jill Barshay has caveats three through six.
Sales of new homes surged 16.2% in April, the biggest amount in 14 years. But the Commerce Department also reported the median price of a new home dropped by the largest amount on record. So is the news good or bad? Dave Siders is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders. He says this is just a spike in sales, and we're still in a depressed housing market.
The builders are saddled with a very heavy inventory overhang. Over half of the builders in my most recent survey saying they are cutting prices to try to move inventory.
Jeff Metzger runs one of the largest home builders in the United States. KB Home is offering discounts and incentives. Buyers are biting in the South.
We've been experiencing good results in the Carolinas and Georgia, where it really never boomed the way it did in Florida and California.
Siders, the economist, says most of the homes that are moving are the lower-priced models. But he says it's good that houses are selling at all. The market won't return to health until the glut of homes is sold. And Siders says that won't happen until later this year.
Nothing has happened out there to make us think that there's a really fundamental turnaround in home buying activity.
Indeed, luxury home builder Toll Brothers said today its profit fell 79% for the quarter. The company didn't offer any hope for an end to the drumbeat of bad news. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Those housing numbers had investors all hot and bothered for an hour or so this morning until they figured out good news in real estate might well mean higher interest rates. In fact, Treasury prices did fall, which sent yields higher. That took the wind out of Wall Street's sails and quick. News that Dell's going to start selling its PCs at Walmart didn't help either. It's a great lesson, really, in how the economy flows downhill. Tech investors got nervous that Walmart would pressure Dell for low, low prices. Dell would then have to pressure its suppliers, like chip companies, for lower prices, which would in turn hurt their profits. It really is one big happy economy when you stop to think about it. Moving now to international trade, 2 days of cabinet-level talks with China have come to a close, a mostly unremarkable close at that. The list of accomplishments is short: more passenger flights between the two countries, better cooperation on food safety and the environment. No breakthroughs, though, on the big-ticket items, from the U.S. perspective anyway. Things like cracking down on piracy or increasing the value of China's currency. It's no coincidence, then, that Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports congressional calls for sanctions just got louder.
Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York and Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina plan to revive their bill to slap across-the-board sanctions on Chinese imports. Senator Graham says the lack of progress from this week's talks makes it time for Congress to act.
The Chinese missed a great opportunity to help relieve some of the pressure, and as a matter of fact, they've reinforced the need for pressure.
Asked about the future of trade with China, President George Bush said the U.S. is watching carefully to see if Beijing will appreciate the country's currency.
And that's all in the context of making it clear to China that we value our relationship, but the $233 billion trade deficit must be addressed.
U.S. retailers and bigger companies that benefit from cheap Chinese imports worry sanctions would spark a debilitating trade war. But smaller companies say they're getting clobbered. Bill Hawkins at the U.S. Business and Industry Council represents them. He says they've given up on the Bush administration's trade negotiators, led by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson.
Henry Paulson was, of course, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, which was a very active investment bank in China. I sort of get the impression that he was taking the pose of being almost a neutral referee between the United States and China, trying to keep things smooth so that his business partnerships can continue.
Anticipating a White House veto of Chinese trade sanctions, congressional sponsors now say they're confident they have veto-proof majorities. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Back in January, congressional Democrats made a big show about all the things they'd get done in their first 100 legislative hours. They checked off a lot of the key issues they'd campaigned on. Left undone was any hint of lobbying reform. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the House of Representatives took action today. It passed two lobbying reform bills with large bipartisan majorities.
Democratic leaders hailed the bills as a major victory, but to get them to the floor of the House for a vote, they had to strip out numerous reforms. One bill requires lobbyists who collect lots of campaign contributions for candidates or political parties to publicly disclose their role raising money. Brian Palash is president of the American League of Lobbyists. He says it's unfair that only lobbyists and not Wall Street bankers or even movie stars have to disclose how they bundle money.
Do you want to know everything about bundling, or do you just want to know about the lobbyists that do it?
Another bill will require new rules for trade associations. It would ban lobbyists from going on most privately sponsored trips. It also increases the penalties for lobbyists who don't follow the rules. Palash says there's a big hole here. Neither bill does anything to step up enforcement.
Congress should enforce the laws and rules that are already there.
Yeah, well, it's weird to be in agreement, but, you know, yeah.
Melanie Sloan's the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She doesn't usually agree with the lobbyists.
It's just ridiculous that it's constantly coming down on the lobbyists and never on members of Congress. It's as if members of Congress can't stop themselves from being seduced by lobbyists, so the people who have to be stopped are the lobbyists. It's like, you know, analogous to saying, you know, I can't have a pretty girl in my office because I won't be able to stop myself from harassing her.
Sloan wanted to see the creation of an Office of Public Integrity to monitor Congress. Other reforms left out included new disclosure rules for grassroots lobbying campaigns. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We all like to think economic reports are just that, solid numbers we can rely on to figure out what's going on and how we're going to be affected. Which is largely true, except for something we told you about on Monday, that gas prices, adjusted for inflation, are the highest they've ever been. When we said it, it was true, but yesterday the Energy Department updated its inflation calculations. Instead of using 2006 figures, it's now using monthly numbers from this year. They're more up to date, says Doug McIntyre. He's a senior oil analyst with the Energy Information Administration.
The reason we did it now was simply because the price was getting close to what people were accustomed to thinking of a peak inflation adjusted price, and it wasn't an accurate comparison.
So what it all boils down to is this. The $3.22 a gallon national average no longer ties the inflation-adjusted record set back in 1981. We'd need to be paying $3.29 a gallon to tie the mark, which might not happen anytime soon. McIntyre's group will be using June's inflation figures next time, so the record's kind of an upwardly moving target. Overseas, crude oil prices closed above $71 today. That didn't help the mood any on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not just money for Iraq and Afghanistan that's being debated on Capitol Hill. House and Senate Democrats have finalized their budget resolutions for next year. $2.9 trillion, a big chunk of it for Social Security and Medicare, much of the rest for big increases for departments like Homeland Security and Veterans Affairs. Commentator Eugene Sterley says those budgetary priorities speak volumes.
Kids. Focusing on kids. Maybe that's the only real way we'll ever straighten out the government's budget problems. You see, the government now promises the average middle-aged couple about $1 million in benefits when they retire. And next year, the baby boomers start retiring in droves. That means in 25 years, about one in three adults will be collecting Social Security. But who will pay for those benefits? Who else? Our kids. When we adults paid our Social Security taxes, most of that was used right away to support our parents and grandparents. Little, if any, was kept in reserve. Now we're counting on younger generations to support us. So you'd think that we might want to invest a little in them. After all, the more productive they are, the more they can provide for us. When you look at the total budget, though, no politician has made a top federal priority out of investing in our kids. Nobody's really talking about all the things we need to do to help all children reach their potential, ranging from prenatal care to early childhood education to higher quality math and science teachers. It's not that we're getting poorer either. The government estimates that we'll have about $650 billion more revenues annually in about 10 years, simply due to economic growth. But all that additional revenue will be eaten up in the form of ever higher benefits for us adults. Almost none will go to our kids. These skewed priorities defy reason. As we invest in kids proportionately less, how can we expect them to get good jobs? Without higher incomes, how can they cover our ballooning benefits? Investment in children needs to become a national priority. Otherwise, all our children will get are budgetary crumbs.
Eugene Sterley is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Your thoughts? You know where to send them. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. Not many people really like to think about this, but where would science and medicine be without animal testing? Many argue not nearly as far along as they are today, but animal testing does have its limits, ethical and practical, because animals aren't people. They can respond differently to drugs and chemicals. So scientists are working on a new breed of experimentation that's cheaper, it's faster, and sometimes even more accurate. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Humans have used animals as predictors of toxicity for at least a century. The old saying, canary in a coal mine, is more than a mere axiom. Since then, billions of animals have died to advance science, and millions will be used this year, too, to test the safety of everything from household products to new cancer drugs. Toxicologist Bruce Fowler says there are about 100,000 chemicals in commercial use, and 1,000 new ones crop up every year. Of that number, less than 10% are known entities.
That means that there is a huge backlog of chemicals that need to be evaluated, not only as individual chemicals, but as mixtures of chemicals, which we're all exposed to.
But even with the backlog, Dr. Fowler says in general, the number of animals used in research has declined by about 50% over the past 25 years. The reason isn't tied to animal rights issues. Fowler says it's about time and money.
Semi-purified rat chow is about $10 per pound.
And food is just the beginning. To test one chemical to see if it's carcinogenic usually requires 500 to 1,000 animals. It takes about 2 years and costs companies millions of dollars in care, housing, and research staff, not to mention how much fun it must be for the animals. So scientists have been quietly developing alternatives that have begun to take off. One uses computer programs to figure out if a substance is dangerous to humans. Dr. Gilles Kloppmann pioneered the software and explains how it works.
You enter into the computer everything you know about carcinogenicity in animals, in humans, etc. And the computer uses a special methodology to identify what is common about these molecules that is probably the cause for the cancer.
Kloppmann says in many cases where data already exist, his software is a better predictor of toxicity than animals are. Still, he says it took decades to convince researchers that they could trust his computer models.
I encountered a lot of problems from some toxicologists who were afraid that they would lose their jobs.
Kloppmann's company, Multicase, charges anywhere from $500 to $100,000 for computer modeling, far less than animal experiments. Clients include the Food and Drug Administration and Eli Lilly, among others. Last year, Multicase billed $2 million in sales and expects that number to grow exponentially this year. But Dr. Mark Dewhurst at Duke University Medical Center says computer models will never replace animal testing.
Because there's no way to model the entire biology of a living animal or person.
Dewhurst's cancer research program at Duke uses several hundred animals each year in dozens of experiments. He says modeling can be a piece of the research puzzle.
It helps us to do the right experiment so that you don't waste a lot of time doing experiments that don't tell you what you want to know.
But Gilles Kloppmann says old ideas just die hard.
The people, of course, who do the animal test will never really accept the fact that you can do something else that is as good or better than what they do.
But Kloppmann says if data are needed on new illnesses, animal tests will be necessary. And while the FDA accepts computer models in the early stages of a drug's development, it still requires that the final product be tested on animals before it's tested in humans. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, could Disneyland have a new British rival?
When you say theme park, it conjures up visions of sort of roller coasters and things, and we're definitely not.
There isn't a Dickens roller coaster.
There's not a roller coaster in sight. I call what we have here pink knuckle rather than white knuckle.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the wah-wah trombones, how I've missed you. The Dow Industrials tumbled to 84 points today, about 0.6% to close at 13,441. The Nasdaq fell 39 points, about 1.5% to finish at 2537. The S&P 500 declined 14 points, a little under 1% to end at 1507. An unexpected rise in new home sales dimmed hopes that the Fed might cut interest rates. Luxury home builder Toll Brothers chipped up 1% despite reporting a 79% drop in second quarter profits. Rival Pulte Homes rose almost 1.5%. Ryland Group inched down 0.3%. Some techs took a hit on disappointing results. Computer maker Network Appliance clicked down about 16.5%. The firm warned that sales and profits may fall short of analysts' estimates. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note was at 4.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies. In select theaters now. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's up for Friday. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, former President Bill Clinton, and Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts will all be delivering speeches at college graduation ceremonies. UN Special Investigator Martin Shannon briefs journalists on America's record on human rights during the War on Terror. And Star Wars fans gather for a convention celebrating the 30th anniversary of the original movie. Happy they will be. I'm Jane Lindholm.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It sounds like something out of a spy movie, but it's actually a good deal less sexy than that. Arguably more important, though. Regulation Z is one of the rules that governs credit in this country. It's part of the truth in lending law. And for the first time in more than 25 years, the Federal Reserve has proposed some new rules about credit cards and how consumers can find out what they need to know. Marketplace's Tess Vigeland is here to fill us in. Hiya, Tess.
Hello, Guy.
So what is the Fed going to do here?
Well, the Fed has proposed several changes to the way credit card companies disclose the terms of your agreement. Right now, for example, they can give you just 15 days' notice before they jack up your interest rate. And quite often, you don't necessarily know that it's happened unless you look in those really teeny tiny fine print flyers that come in the statement. This would require that the companies give you 45 days' notice. And the benefit of that is that if you're anticipating a higher interest rate, you could potentially, for example, go and transfer to a different card.
Is it going to do anything for actual interest rates, though?
It could potentially, especially regarding the fixed interest rate that you are often promised by your credit card. Technically, it's not like a mortgage where the rate is truly fixed for 10, 30 years. On a credit card, they can change what is called a fixed interest rate. And what this would require credit card companies to do is to tell you how long you are actually going to get that percentage.
All this presupposes that consumers, when they get their credit card bill, do something other than take the statement out, put it in the bills to be paid pile, and then chuck all the rest of it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't read any of that other stuff.
I don't either.
Is it going to be somehow more obviously disclosed to us?
It will. One of the other proposals is that any change to the terms in your agreement actually be on the top of your statement above the list of all your purchases. So the first thing you would see on your statement is that your interest rate is going to go from 9.9% to 30% for whatever reason. So you wouldn't have to necessarily go through that teeny tiny brochure that sometimes comes with the statement.
Congress is doing some things on credit cards and rates and notification as well. How is that different from what the Fed's doing?
What the Fed is dealing with is really the disclosure of changes to your agreement. They want it to be very clear to you what your interest rate is and what changes have been made to your agreement. What Congress is looking at is actually outlawing some of the practices that credit card companies do. For example, the big one is universal default, where you're late or you don't make a credit card payment on one card, and all of a sudden your interest rates on all your other credit cards go up. They're looking at potentially outlawing that. So it's really a matter of disclosure versus outlawing some of the practices.
This, what the Fed is doing, is a rule, not a new law. So the public gets a comment period, right? None of this happens right away.
Yes, they have 120 days to comment, both the I'm sure we'll be hearing from the industry and from consumer groups and consumers themselves. After that, the Fed could potentially change some of these proposals. We probably won't see anything until early next year, but at least perhaps there's a light at the end of the tunnel for consumers who are very frustrated with their credit card companies.
All right, Tess Vigeland, she's the host of our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. Thank you, Tess.
Thanks, Guy.
On the theory that every marketing campaign needs a good gimmick, Simon & Schuster is turning to the internet. The publishing company is going to start an online video channel featuring chats with authors talking about their books and walking through the places those books are set. A group of British investors is taking that idea a step further. They've poured more than $120 million into England's newest tourist attraction. Dickens World opens to the general public tomorrow. Our man in London, Stephen Beard, went down to Chatham in southern England for a sneak preview.
The customers, when they come through, will come through this way.
And managing director Kevin Christie led me into a building site. By tomorrow, it should be transformed into a multi-million dollar visitor attraction.
Clients arrive here, and as they step into this space, this is their first view of Dickens' world.
The scene will transport visitors back to Victorian London, with the cobbled alleyways, ramshackle warehouses and wharves. Tomorrow, if all goes to plan, these streets will be filled with the sounds and even the smells of Dickensian England. Looks like a theme park, but it's not, says Christie.
We're a themed attraction, not a theme park, because when you say theme park, you know, people conjures up visions of sort of roller coasters and things, and we're definitely not.
There isn't a Dickens roller coaster.
There's not a roller coaster in sight, and I call what we have here pink knuckle rather than white knuckle.
There is one ride called Great Expectations. Passengers will board small wooden boats and be whisked over the rooftops and plunged down through a murky but make-believe sewer, complete with mechanical rats. Other attractions include a visit to a reconstructed debtor's prison.
The dirty windows looked into a gravelled area, bounded by a high brick wall topped by iron spikes.
This is a replica of the jail where Dickens's father served a sentence for debt. The author's fictional characters are everywhere here. There are life-size robot-like models of them haranguing the visitors.
Am I what folks call a miser? Only a miser? A jolly old gentleman, I'm reviewing the situation.
And the robots reenact famous scenes from the novels.
Who are you?
Ask me who I was.
Who were you then?
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
The object of Dickens' world, says Kevin Christie, is to entertain and educate, and of course, first and foremost, to make money from the $25 a head entrance fee and from the merchandising operation dubbed the Old Curiosity Shop.
We're going to have a range of goods, mugs, T-shirts, but then at the high end, we're looking at branded goods at the high end, such as cases of wine, Christmas cakes, hampers.
And they'll all have the Dickens label, logo.
The Dickens branding, Dickens World branding, absolutely right.
One or two academics have dismissed Dickens World as Disneyfication, but the author's great-great-grandson, Gerald Dickens, has given it his blessing.
If one person or one family gets intrigued, gets fascinated by the characters and stories, and then goes and reads one of the novels, and then gets more fascinated and reads a biography, and then starts, that's a great thing.
The only question is whether Dickens' world will pull in the crowds or prove a little highbrow for most people. Dickens always took a keen interest in his own commercial success. No doubt he'll be here, in spirit, hovering over the project to make sure that it succeeds. His fictional characters, too.
You fail, and your heart and liver will be torn out and ate.
At Dickens World in Chatham, Kent, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You can see Dickens World for yourself on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, in which we put to rest the issue of exactly how you pronounce the name of Chrysler's German parent company. We mentioned yesterday there had been some objections to our use of Daimler, that it ought to be Daimler, and how we'd called company headquarters outside Detroit to check.
Thank you for calling the Daimler Chrysler Corporation.
Several of you wrote last night to point out that since it's a German company, we should have called Stuttgart. So here you go.
Guten Tag, Daimler Chrysler, Claudia Nanfaro.
Caught us by surprise, we were expecting a recording.
Guten Tag, Daimler Chrysler.
Which is where we hung up, because we don't speak German. The best letter, though, came from Joe Petschy of West Lynn, Oregon. He suggested we ask Daimler executives how they pronounce it. They'd probably say that the Chrysler part's meant to be silent. And das ist Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm sorry I had to. Today, the Dow dropped 84.6 tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 39 points. That is 1.5%. The S&P 500 lost 14 points, a little under 1%. If you miss us on the radio, try our podcast. It's convenient for you. And the link is on our website. It's marketplace.org. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the actual radio program, A Fish Only a Mother Could Love.
The menhaden is a runt of a fish, small, smelly, bony, and oily. You wouldn't eat it, and you sure wouldn't hang it on your wall.
But you're going to hear all about it tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.